Welcome to the Leeds Church Institute podcast. LCI is a faith-based organisation for lifelong learning. You can find out more about the Leeds Church Institute by visiting lcileeds.org.
Kavada, you've been relatively recently come to Durham. Was it about 18 months ago? Yeah, that's right. So it's really good to have you. So Kavada is Professor of Catholic Theology at the University of Durham, but she's got a particular interest in creation and stewardship and climate science and so on. So we're really pleased that you've made the journey today by train and in the rain. And it's lovely to have you with us. Thank you.
So thanks Bishop Paul, and thanks Helen for the invitation. Helen invited me to come last year. It was last year, wasn't it? And they weren't letting me out last year. So this is my first year of freedom and being able to do what I want and accept the invitations that I want. And I'm really very, very glad to be here and very excited to see you all and very excited to hear everything we've been hearing about what's happening specifically in Leeds, which is just kind of hugely encouraging, hugely inspiring. I work in this field as a researcher, and I teach in this field at Durham, and I also work with a very wide range of different types of audience, both within and without faith communities. And I've been doing that for basically since Laudato Si came out. Put your hand up if you don't know what Laudato Si is. Okay, thanks. So Laudato Si is Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment, an encyclical letter being the highest level of a Pope's documentary teaching, as in when the Pope writes something down. There's a kind of hierarchy of documentary productions of a Pope. An encyclical is the highest level of teaching. It's hard to communicate for me. It's hard to put words to what a total game changer it was when Laudato Si came out. I knew it was in the works. I was doing my PhD at the time and working on these areas. I heard about a year after Pope Francis had been elected, we started to hear that he was working on this document. We, of course, knew that it was going to be one of his major concerns because of his name. Right, that when he took his papal name, it became clear that ecology, in the broader sense, and care for creation was going to be something he was concerned about. But when I heard there was an encyclical letter being written about it, I just couldn't really believe it. An encyclical letter is like the Pope saying to every single person in the church, think about this now. And when the day it actually came out, I was in the library. And I'd sort of promised myself that I wasn't going to read it until I'd finished my working day, because I thought I can't miss a working day. I was running up to doing my write-up. So I'm sitting there in the library, and this is a kind of day I've been looking forward to for a long time. And I thought, well, you know what? It won't do any harm if I just read the first paragraph. So I read the first paragraph, and I thought, maybe I'll just read the first section. And I read the first section, and that was the end of that day. I read the whole thing in one sitting, and it's not short, actually. Has anyone actually read it? Okay, awesome, great. So genuinely, by the time I was reading the end, I realized, from the looks of people around me, that I was crying. I was just totally and utterly overwhelmed. And it's not really the thing one of the things that I want to say to you is that it's not really that it's new. It's always been there in the tradition. It's always been there in all our traditions, right? It was just the Pope kind of dusting it off and bringing it out and saying, even if you never knew about this, it's time for you to stop and listen. He wasn't saying, and critics will tell you, if any of you have the misfortune to bump into them, that it is new and it isn't. It isn't new. It's an ancient part of Christian heritage, of the heritage of all Christians, this way of thinking, which I'll tell you about, a little bit about in a moment. But it was kind of a real, and I think the key word for this, and I'm going to come back to this later, the key word is kairos, right? For those of you who work in New Testament will be familiar with the concept of kairos. It means, the old-fashioned translation, an appointed time. When Paul says, now is the day of salvation. It's kind of like, this is a critical moment. Of course, Christians always live in a kairos, right? I mean, all of us always live in a kairos, because now is always the time that we have to act. Pope Francis was saying, this kairos, this is a moment of invitation, and in a sense, a moment of judgment for every human being living on this planet, to recognize what we're doing and to change course. And he uses this phrase, change course, again and again and again. And that relates to one of the key kind of concepts that he develops in the document, which I'll talk about, which is ecological conversion, this concept of changing course. So I'm going to share with you a little bit of what is in Laudato Si, but I first just want to situate it briefly. The environment and care for the environment was mentioned and was a theme in Catholic social teaching. So this is the development of papal teaching on topics to do with life in society, basically. It has been there for a long time. It was becoming gradually more prominent. Laudato Si has kind of given it a full force and a full centrality. But the particular moment in recent Catholic history that I think most helpfully illuminates this actually happened in the Second Vatican Council, which many of you will be familiar with. Probably the single most famous sentence in the Second Vatican Council, so this was the gathering of the Church's bishops between 1962 and 1965, when the Church kind of developed a new response to the situation of Christians and modernity, shall we say, to be simple. Most famous sentence in Vatican II is the opening sentence of Gaudium et Spes, the document known as Gaudium et Spes, which means joy and hope. And it goes like this. The joys and the hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of the people of our age are the joys and the hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of the followers of Christ. In other words, there was henceforth to be no distinction between what matters for someone else and what matters for you as a Christian. It was a kind of dramatic and very difficult for many people eroding of any kind of safe boundaries between the church and the world. It was basically saying to the church, what's going on in the world is your problem. All the time. You can't turn your back, you can't walk away, you can't make that secondary or someone else's concern. Laudato Si is just an extrapolation of the first sentence of Gaudium et Spes. It's happening to our world, therefore it's happening to you. Those griefs and anxieties must be yours. And Pope Francis uses this language, which interestingly, by the way, he takes from Pope Benedict, which is important because a lot of people are making a lot of mileage at the moment out of this supposed antagonism between Pope Francis and Pope Benedict, which we need to remember is a very gratifying narrative for the media, right? Pope Benedict's work is quoted repeatedly in Pope Francis's teaching. Pope Benedict said something which Francis quotes in Laudato Si about the disfigurement of the earth being a disfigurement of our own bodies and the importance of experiencing desertification or deforestation or pollution or whatever it is as a disfigurement of our own bodies. In other words, he's encouraging us, Francis is encouraging very explicitly that we have to turn the world's pain into our own pain. It has to become ours. It can't remain over there. It's got to be imported into our own consciousness. We've got to own that and carry it. And of course, there's two levels of this, right? There's, on the one level, a kind of spiritual responsibility, right? Where we're basically saying we don't accept a division between us and them. We recognize that we're part of each other. So there's that spiritual responsibility, solidarity, we might say. But there's also a moral responsibility, which is recognizing that everything I do affects everybody else. And that although it looks like someone else's problem, it's always involved with me in some way. That I can't outsource it morally. And I can't outsource it spiritually either. So that lens of Gaudium et Spes, that first sentence, the joys and the hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of the people of this age are the joys and the hopes and the griefs and the anxieties of the followers of Christ. This is the best way of understanding, in a way, what Laudato Si is doing. It's just a very, very detailed, specific working out of that. Just going to take one more step back before we look into Laudato Si in terms of the kind of key concepts a bit further. I always think with... Helen asked me to speak about my tradition. Otherwise, I wouldn't kind of presume to share this with you. Although, actually, certainly your Christian traditions share this, I think, implicitly, if not explicitly. The clue to Catholicism is in the title. The word Catholic means, in Greek, as those of you who study New Testament Greek will recognize this, it means, the Greek is kataholon. Kataholon means just according to the whole, or about the whole, or about everything. Catholicism is just like a longer word for what we might call holism. Catholicism, when it's functioning, is a spiritual concern and a spiritual solidarity with absolutely everything there is. It's supposed to be cosmic, it's not supposed to be local. And this, of course, is something that is repeatedly and routinely obscured, right, as in all of our traditions falling short from the things that they say they're going to be about. And in Catholicism, in the sense of the kind of Roman Catholic Church, it often gets used as a kind of tribal word. But it isn't used like that, really, in the early thinkers of the early church. It's not really used like that in the scriptures. It's used to describe the way that God is concerned about everything that God has made, and that the church must therefore be concerned with everything that God has made. There's no outside to that. There's no exceptions. There's no exclusions. Nothing. Pope Francis says, and he's actually not referring specifically to the word Catholic, but it's kind of in the background. He says, God, this is Laudato Si, he says, God has united himself in Christ. God has united himself definitively with our earth. We're not even talking about a wholeness of the human community. We're talking about the wholeness of creation itself. And creation is the most unrestricted word there is. Creation is just everything that's not God, which is, of course, everything, because God is not a thing. So let's just talk for briefly, and I hope simply, about the concepts that Laudato Si uses, because this kind of gives us a feeling for how the Catholic tradition is developing tools for thinking about this. Right, the first thing is, Laudato Si is addressed to every single person living on this planet, explicitly. That's actually how it's framed. It's an address to everybody. It's not just an address to Catholics or even just Christians or even just people of faith, although it obviously has particular relevance for them, but it is specifically an address to all people. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it is not supposed to be, and it doesn't present itself as, an answer to our problem. It isn't supposed to be, if only you read this and do what it says, everything will be fine. What it is, and I'm quoting, it is a call to an inclusive dialogue. It is very explicitly supposed to start conversations. It is not supposed to finish them. And this is really relevant to what we're talking about this evening and what Jemima was just remarking on with the pledges. Pope Francis, it's almost as though he's saying the most important thing you can do is start conversations in all the different ways that we do that, and that includes nonverbal ways. Just those exchanges where we learn from each other and we grow and we allow ourselves to be changed. And he says, and this is a hallmark of his teaching, by the way, which is something that some Catholics also find quite difficult, that he doesn't think it's the role of a pope to provide answers. By implication, the role of religious leaders in general. They're not providing answers, but they are trying to start conversations. Okay, so that's the second thing. The first thing is it's a universal address. The second thing is an attempt to start conversations and generate a dialogue. And incidentally, it has quite a dialogical style, a kind of conversational style, as Francis does in general. Third thing, I mentioned that he's not trying to solve the problem in any direct sense, although he is hoping that we are going to solve the problem. But he is trying to reframe the problem. He is trying to offer parameters for us to think about this problem. And again, these aren't coming from him. They're coming from the tradition in the broadest sense. And he's very careful, by the way, to use the word Christian when he talks about that. He's talking about that heritage that Christians have in common. He's not talking about some kind of sectarian Catholic tradition. So how does he reframe the problem? Well, briefly, I'm going to try to be brief because a lot of Laudato Si is dedicated to this. And this, I think, is maybe one of the prophetic contributions that faith traditions can make, thinking more generally of how our faith traditions can make a specific contribution, which we've already been kind of challenged to think about. What's specific about the contribution of faith traditions? Pope Francis says, I'm abbreviating, but it's pretty clear, those of you who've read it will already be familiar with this, that environmental change, and by that I'm including not just climate change, but also what people are calling the nature crisis. I find that a bit funny because climate is part of nature. But anyway, by that they generally mean biodiversity collapse, right? We have these kind of twin threats, climate change and biodiversity collapse. That this environmental change is not mainly a managerial problem. Even though science and policy and industry and government talk about it as though it was a managerial problem. That is to say, they talk about it as though it was mainly a kind of technical, practical problem to which the appropriate response is better management of resources, better planning, better technology, and so on and so on. Francis isn't saying that it is not also a managerial problem, but it is not primarily a managerial problem. And he actually thinks, and he's quite provocative about this, that it's very dangerous to let ourselves think that it is primarily a managerial problem. He says, and this is, he's a man capable of harsh words, that it is primarily a moral problem and a spiritual problem, and that our reluctance to see that is a symptom of just how serious our moral and spiritual problem is. That we are really paralytically reluctant to admit this isn't about an inadequacy in our technology, it's about an inadequacy in our hearts. And if we aren't willing to see that, we are in a seriously parlous state. Recognizing that we are the problem is the first step. And this, of course, leads us straight into one of the more, shall we say, discussed concepts developed in the encyclical, which is ecological conversion. Francis basically says true conversion is ecological conversion in the sense that how we relate to our environment can never be separated from how we relate to God and other people. And he says a conversion that hasn't become ecological is simply incomplete. And that's a provocative thing to say. In other words, it's not just about putatively religious activities being converted. Is about the whole way that you live. And of course, the flip side of talking about ecological conversion is that he defines explicitly, and by the way, he's quoting Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew when he does this, so the leader of Orthodox Christians, that there is such a thing as ecological sin. That it is a real, genuine contravention of God's purposes to treat creation without respect. That it deserves the term sin, and it's something of which we should repent and for which we should feel remorse. Right, so this is all about stopping the conversation from being purely at the external level about some kind of technical problem-solving rationality for something that's over there, and we don't have to change. It's all about actually this internalization, realizing how wrapped up we are in this, morally and spiritually, and taking responsibility for that. Because that's in a way what, if we were to try to translate this beyond the bounds of faith communities, many of which, most of which perhaps, have a language of sin, what we're really talking about is people being willing to take responsibility for themselves. People not outsourcing their responsibility and saying, well, it's not my fault. But people saying, I am part of this. I take responsibility for my share. So there's kind of, to summarise that, there's three related aspects of this reframing of the problem. It's not a managerial problem, primarily. It is also. Not primarily a managerial problem, it's primarily a moral and a spiritual problem. That's one. It's not primarily an external problem, but it's primarily an internal problem in our hearts. That's two. And it's not primarily a matter of poor technology. It's a matter of the agents of the technology, that is to say, those who are using it, which is us. It's not about whether or not someone's invented something or other that can solve something, or, you know, it's not, that's not the stage that we need to be examining. The stage we need to be examining is how are we using these things, or indeed not using them. Okay, so ecological sin and ecological conversion and the reframing of the problem. So what's the model, that positive model that Pope Francis proposes to think about it constructively? Because there's no shying away from the fact that a lot of the document is negative. A lot of it is saying, this is a situation of judgment. This is a situation, you know, in the letters of Paul, St. Paul in the New Testament, Paul talks about the way that God enacts God's judgment against human beings is that he hands them over to the effects of their own actions. He just allows what we do to take its course. That's God's judgment. Pope Francis is describing the environmental crisis as God's judgment. Right, you've done this, now you see how that goes, kind of thing. So the positive model. The best short summary of this is a not very illuminating phrase, but I'll use it anyway because it's very common in Catholic kind of discourse about this, and it's really not complicated at all, and it kind of captures the key idea. The phrase is integral ecology. Integral ecology is the way that Catholic tradition thinks about the human being in the world. Let me explain it very briefly. We'll start with the word ecology. Ecology has become a widespread word in Catholic social teaching. Why? Because ecology is, at the most simple level, as lots of you will know, the science of relationships. Right? If you look up the word ecology, it's about the way in which organisms relate to one another in their environment. It comes from the Greek word oikos, which is home or household. In other words, it's looking at the world, particularly the natural world, as a home or a household in which organisms relate to one another the way that people do in a household. Right, so it's a way of saying the primary category in which we're going to think about the place, our place in the world, is the category of relationship. The thriving or the diminishing of people and beings, creatures, in relationship. So that's the ecology part. The integral part is this, that a human being exists in three intertwined and never ever separable relationships. And those relationships are with one another, with God, and with nature, the earth, other creatures. The simple principle of integral ecology is they must never be separated. That's what the word integral means. They have to be integrated. Cutting off one of them will always distort the others. That's the simple kind of functional principle of Catholic thinking about nature and environment and people and climate change and technology and all these things. And it's not, as I said at the beginning, it's not a solution to our problems, but it's a model for thinking about them in. That as long as we separate any one of those relationships from the others, we'll go wrong. Pope Francis was much criticized for repeatedly using in the text the phrase, everything is connected. People accused him of kind of importing what they perceived as being Indian or Asian or pagan ideas, which they didn't think kind of came from Christian scripture, which is very bizarre as an attack. And it's true, it is one of the most repeated claims that he makes in Laudato Si. Everything is connected, everything is connected. But it is, of course, indigenous. It's indigenous to Christian thinking. Why? Because in the Christian tradition, Catholic tradition, God is a web of relationships. God is a trinity. God is not a monadic unity. God actually is a relationship in God's own self, and creation reflects that. Which is why the accent is always on connection and relationship, and living as though you really are related to everything else, because you are. Living according to integral ecology, living according to Laudato Si, is living as though you were related to absolutely everything else. And that nothing that you do is without impact, either for good or for ill. So that's integral ecology. Just to say again, because this really can't be overstated, this doesn't tell us what any of us should do, but it does help us to think about the problem and have criteria for assessing solutions. Okay, I have time to say a couple more things about Laudato Si. There's one area, I'll say two more things about Laudato Si. There's an awful lot that could be said, right? But I'll say two more things. The first thing is, if we can't separate those relationships in which we exist, with God, with one another, and with the earth, it has an interesting consequence for the way that we frame environmental problems, which is that they are always also social problems. That we can't set nature and culture over against each other, that we can't treat social and environmental problems in isolation. In particular, it means that so-called green approaches that don't also become social approaches are incomplete. And in the same way, attempts to solve social problems that don't respond to and take into account environmental conditions in the very most general sense are also going to be half-baked. When the document was coming out, somebody said to Pope Francis something like, I'm so looking forward to reading your environmental encyclical. And he said, it's not an environmental encyclical. Which was a kind of cryptic thing to say at the time. But when you read the text, it's clear that that's because he doesn't think that that set of problems can be isolated from social problems or spiritual problems or moral problems or any of the other problems. It's kind of an expression of that holism. And in particular, this means, and this is the hardest part, I think, practically, that we can't set nature and humans over against each other as though there was an either-or here. We can't trade them off, we can't play them against each other, we can't set it up as though there's a kind of zero-sum game, and what one gains, the other loses. It's very tempting to do that. Perhaps the most awkward thing about Catholic social teaching, this tradition of thinking that I'm describing, perhaps the strongest reason to criticize it is that it makes that so axiomatic. It simply refuses that either-or mentality. Some people say that's just not realistic. Well, I leave that to you to go away and think about. But there it is. It's not social or environmental. It's not human or natural. It's always both and. And incidentally, it's true from the other side, by the way, that if you have Catholics in particular are guilty of this, and you will all have your own experience of this from your traditions, but that there's a tendency to think that being so-called pro-life can be limited to thinking about certain very narrow ethical questions. Those ethical questions are really bloody important. But if a pro-life approach doesn't become an environmental approach, it's just as silly as having a green approach that doesn't become a social approach. The two halves of the conversation need to join up. Right, final thing about Laudato Si specifically. Sometimes people have the impression, and they're not completely wrong, that Christians think that our souls are going to be plucked out of this world and taken somewhere much better called heaven. And that this reality is going to be folded up and thrown in the bin because it will have served its purpose. And that the environment that we live in and plants and animals and all the rest of it is just like furniture. It's just like a really nice setting for us to live our life here below. But the main thing is not to get too distracted. Just keep going. The only real innovation, and I say this very tentatively because it's a dangerous word for anybody to use in Catholic theology, the only real innovation in Laudato Si is this, that Pope Francis says, more explicitly than has ever been said, and I'm going to quote, that at the end of time, the eschaton, this is the quote, each creature, resplendently transfigured, will take its rightful place. Each creature will take its rightful place. In other words, everybody is on this journey together, human and non-human, and God doesn't make in order to throw away. God makes in order to save, full stop. And this is, of course, a fundamental theological principle in general, that creation and salvation are not two separate acts. It's not God doing one thing and then later being like, oh, I might also do that. It's one divine act, and there's one central player in both acts, and that is Christ, who is the Logos in the beginning as well as at the end. So insofar as there is an innovation in Laudato Si, it's that. And it does have very dramatic implications, in particular for the way in which we treat non-human life. So this isn't directly related to what we're talking about this evening, but I wanted to say this at the risk of making Laudato Si sound as though it doesn't really say anything controversial. That is going a little bit beyond what had been explicitly said before. Okay, so some concluding comments. In the kind of secular sphere, there's a word that is bandied around remarkably confidently all the time, despite the fact that it begs a massive question. This is pertaining to the whole issue of what faith communities have to contribute. And that word is sustainability. And it is absolutely astonishing that although everybody talks about sustainability all the time, nobody stops and asks what it is that we want to sustain. They're too busy worrying about resource management to ask, but what's it all for anyway? But that question doesn't go away just because we don't talk about it. What that reveals is questions about value and questions about the good and questions about meaning and purpose and the direction of things are there in the heart of our environmental crisis, even if we're not acknowledging them. And that, to take another step beyond that, we can't really address those without using something like the languages of faith. And I'm not talking necessarily about faith traditions in any formal sense or institutions or anything like that, but that's the conversation that faith traditions already know how to have. They already speak that moral language, that language about what is good and how do we know what's good and how do we live towards what's good. That's what faith traditions specialise in. They specialise in, shall we say, transformational thinking. They specialise in thinking about the fundamental, not just the practical, but the fundamental that is always presupposed by the practical. And those resources are never more needed, have never been more needed than they are now. Alistair MacIntyre, who's a philosopher I'm quite fond of, said that our moral language is in a state of grave disrepair. People don't even know what these terms mean anymore. People don't know what the term good means anymore, other than something I happen to like. That's not what the word good means in any of the great traditions of thought that we inherit from the past. Faith traditions, even if individuals couldn't articulate it, are still drawing from those wells. And that's what they have to give. And it's a resource that the public conversation simply cannot do without. Because we do need to ask what it is that we want to sustain. We can't just talk about what to do with our coal or not to do with it. That's a really important question. But we can only know the answer to it if we ask, what is the meaning of human community? What's its direction? What are its norms? And all of those related questions, which we all kind of inherit languages about that. But it's not happening in that wider conversation, really. Or it's happening only in a very unconscious and unexplicit way. That's something faith communities can really do. And that's why, to bring it back to where we started with what's happening in Leeds and taking the pledges, hopefully, that's why it really does matter to start those conversations and to take those pledges and to not go into those encounters assuming that faith traditions are just replicating in a slightly less good way something that's happening in labs or in governing, in government. It's not true. There are unique resources that each one of you is sitting on that you have to give that can actually totally raise the conversation to a new level. And the thing is to have the confidence in that, to have the confidence in your tradition and the confidence that that conversation, even if you can't measure it or follow it, will actually go somewhere, will do something, even if you never know about it. Very final practical thing. This has already been mentioned, but I simply cannot say this with enough passion. In fact, I have to restrain myself seriously. If we let Brexit be the main issue of this election, we have failed. Brexit is not important in comparison to this. We know that we are living in the last window to avoid apocalyptic scales of change that will make Brexit look like a tea party. And it is absolutely unacceptable, in my view, that people who claim to represent us, and I'm not saying that they're in simple positions, they aren't, but they are claiming to represent us, they cannot be said to do that if they aren't talking about this. They simply are not representing us at all. And it's, you know, they are accountable to us. And we need to make sure that we exercise that. They shouldn't be allowed to talk about Brexit until they've told us how our homes are not going to be underwater in this liberated Britain that we're all moving towards. I mean, it won't be very useful to have left Europe if I'm swimming. It's just kind of it's farcical. It is really farcical. If it wasn't true, it would be hilarious. And it really is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic on a number of metaphorical levels. So we all have whatever kinds of influences we have. Let's try and use them to make sure that this election doesn't get away with being only about Brexit. Because, as I said in the column I literally just sent off to the tablet this morning, those of you who might read the tablet, it really would be a shame if we gained Britain and lost the whole world. Okay, I think that's enough from me.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Leeds Church Institute. If you'd like to know more about the Leeds Church Institute, visit lcileeds.org.